Let's welcome our science commentator today, Alan Blackman, Professor of Chemistry, School of Science, Auckland University of Technology. So what did Roman wine taste like? Speaking of historical fiction, you can help with the research for Karen's next novel.
Well, there we go. So some workers in Belgium and Poland had this exact question. What does Roman wine taste like? And so I sort of did a little bit of research on this just to see what the oldest bottle of wine known is. And it actually dates remarkably from around about 330 CE, which blew me away. They found about 12 bottles of wine in a tomb of a Roman couple. So they obviously got buried with the things that they loved. And so these workers in Belgium and Poland sort of thought, well, okay, what does or what did Roman wine taste like? And so in order to answer this question, they were looking for winemaking processes in the sort of the modern day that perhaps replicate what the Romans did. And the one thing that the Romans did when it came to wine was they used clay jars, which they called dolia. And so that got these folk thinking, and they thought, oh, hang on, I know that when they make wine in Georgia, that they use earthenware vessels called, and forgive my Georgian, kevevri. And they sort of thought, okay, well, let's have a look at this in a little bit more detail and see if we can sort of extrapolate what the Georgians are doing nowadays back to the Roman days. And so your modern day wines, your big wineries and everything, they're generally doing all the fermentation in metal containers and stuff. But the earthenware, the clay containers that the Georgians and the Romans used are porous. And so that means that you can get air in there during fermentation, or at least some air anyway. And what the Romans did was to cover the interior with a resin that came from pine trees. And the Georgians currently use beeswax for the same thing, to control the amount of air present during the fermentation. And that apparently gives a grassy, a nutty, dried fruit sort of flavours to these Georgian wines. And so again, you know, extrapolating back to the Romans, that is possibly what they tasted like. Also very important, surprisingly, is the shape of the vessel that is used. So both the Romans and the current day Georgians, they use egg-shaped vessels. So what that means is that the contents of the wine, the liquid contents, can sort of move around with thermal currents and stuff like that, but the solids at the bottom don't have too much contact with the actual liquid because of that egg shape. And that's very important because it means that you don't get all the sort of the nasty flavors and stuff that comes from the stems and the seeds and stuff like that. But it's got just enough contact to impart the wine with a particular color. And that color is not our usual white or red or perhaps rosé as we're used to today. But in fact, it's orange. And anybody listening who knows a little bit about wine will know that you know, orange wine is a bit of a thing at the moment, and seemingly this is probably what was happening back in Roman times, that they were making this orange sort of wine. And what they also did was to bury these jars, and that meant that you kept a relatively constant temperature. And these workers who are studying this, they estimate roughly between about 13 and 28 degrees Celsius for the constant-ish temperature during the fermentation. And the fact that the jars are buried encourages the formation of these yeasts called floor yeasts, and they form a big white thick foam on top of the wine. And again, that limits access of air during fermentation. And apparently, again, according to those who know, this gives a spicy taste, and toast and apples, roasted nuts, and remarkably curry. So if you want to know what Roman wines taste like, or tasted like, I guess, go and find yourself a bottle of the best Georgian wine, and you might have a decent idea anyway.
All right.
Of course, don't store your wines in lead amphoras like the Romans did, and sort of, you know, all get lead poisoning and die out. That's a no-no, okay?
Thanks for the advice. Now, polar forests may just have solved a solar storm mystery dating back to the 19th century.
Yeah, this is very interesting. Obviously, things solar are in people's minds at the moment, I guess, with the big solar eclipse that was last week. Was it last week? Week before. over in the States. And of course, there's going to be one in good old Dunners in about 4 years' time, I think, 2028. It looks like the path of totality goes over there. Are you a Dunners person?
By origin, I am indeed.
Oh, good on you. Well, there we go. Snap. Anyway, let's go to 1859 and a thing called the Carrington Event, which was the biggest solar flare that has been in sort of modern recorded history. And how do we know this? Well, a guy by the name of Carrington managed to view it by projecting it through a telescope and seeing these massive solar flares. And then, of course, there was lots of auroral activity and stuff like that goes with these things. But so what they've got is they've got sort of observations and stuff, but they've got no sort of permanent record, no physical record of the fact that this massive solar flare actually occurred until now. And so it's been, yeah, something that people have been very confused about, that normally these things should leave some sort of record in the form of good old carbon-14, our radioactive isotope of carbon, because that's sort of the trail that these things leave. So they leave carbon-14, certainly in the atmosphere, and that carbon-14 should be incorporated into living things, e.g. trees, etc., etc. And so people have looked for evidence of this excess carbon-14 in trees, but they've made the mistake up until now of looking for this in sort of lower latitudes, so in your Japans and your USAs and sort of places like that. And they've never gone to sort of extreme latitudes like the polar latitudes. So what happens in with a solar flare is that we get bombarded with these very, very energetic particles as they come towards the Earth, and they hit the Earth's magnetic field. They get deflected up towards the poles, both up and down. And that is where the carbon-14 production takes place, so up sort of near the poles. And so these workers from, not surprisingly, Finland primarily, but also some from Japan, the UK and Switzerland, got together and thought, okay, let's go and look up in the polar regions. Let's see if we can detect any of this excess carbon-14 in trees up beyond the Arctic Circle. And so they've done this, and surprise, surprise, they found sort of increased levels of carbon-14 that exactly mirror the 1859 Carrington event. So, and they looked at the trees above the Arctic Circle in Finland, and then they came down in latitude as well. They called it moderate latitudes, but that's still fairly far north. But they found that the trees sort of in the southern part of Finland, they didn't have these particular elevated levels of C14, or certainly not as much anyway. So they think that they've sort of figured this out now, that they've got the signature for this big event that happened in 1859. They also know from writings that there were similar big solar flares in 1582, 1730 and 1770. So the hunt now is on for those as well.
All right. Well, no doubt you'll update us.
Oh, gosh, I will keep you.
Now, let's talk about, we talk about GOAT a lot, the greatest of all time.
Indeed.
Let's talk about BOAT, the brightest cosmic blast of all time.
Yes. So sticking with things solar or certainly universal. So the brightest gamma ray burst of all time. So they have nicknamed this the BOAT, the brightest of all time. Not the GOAT, not Nathan Lyon. And the good old James Webb Space Telescope, again, integral to all of this. So this actually happened in 2022, but it was so bright that they couldn't actually look at it directly. It's kind of looking at the sun with, you know, just bare eyes, as it were. So they had to wait a while this thing calmed down. And then they were sort of trying to figure out, right, this is exceptionally bright. What was it? They didn't think that it came from any of the normal sort of sources, like things like supernovae and stuff like that. But what they did find is that when it had calmed down, they analyzed it and said, oh, gosh, it is a supernova. It just seems to be an extraordinarily concentrated one. Maybe the light was just sort of concentrated and we were in the right place and we saw it as being exceptionally bright. But the actual size of the supernova itself was not anything out of the ordinary. But still, they had a chance to look at the remnants of the supernova, in particular for heavy metals, and heavy metals, things like gold and platinum and stuff like that, because one of the big questions in cosmology is how did the heavy elements get formed? We know how everything from hydrogen to iron got formed from the Big Bang and in stars, etc., etc., but how do the really, really heavy ones get formed? We don't know, and it turns out we still don't know, because what they thought happened was that these would be formed in supernovae. They're not. They didn't get any evidence for the formation of heavy elements from this thing, which was the brightest gamma ray burst of all time. So we need a new theory, I think, Catherine. The upshot.
The boat kind of didn't deliver the answers to everything. Goodness it didn't, because then what would anyone have left to study and hypothesise?
Heaps of things, Catherine, heaps of things.
Thank you, Alan. Thanks very much. Alan Blackman, our science commentator today.